Hey fam, thanks for listening to the Better Man Podcast. This season, the podcast is brought to you by Aroga Drive, one of my favorite energy supplements. If you're looking for all-day clean energy that won't let you crash and burn, Drive is the one. Stop pounding the coffee, stop crushing the Red Bulls. Instead, take Aroga Drive one time in the morning and you're good for the rest of the day. Check it out in the show notes or visit arogadrive.com.
Welcome to the Better Man Podcast. This is part two of our interview with Professor Nancy Piercy on the toxic war on masculinity. If you haven't heard part one, we encourage you to listen to part one of the conversation before continuing with this episode. Now let's again join Dr. Chris Harper and Professor Nancy Piercy in a short recap.
So my book is Stop the Scolding.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my message. No more scolding. How about encouraging and supporting?
Yes.
Yeah. Men to that actually you're doing very well.
Yeah, we're not gonna shame and guilt men into God's design. We're not gonna shame and guilt men back into the church. You know, one of the things I love about Better Man is we often say we're not winning men back to the church. We're trying to win the church back to men.
Oh.
And
yes.
I was recently with a very prominent church leader in San Antonio. And he asked me, he said, Chris, what's one thing we could do today to help recapture some of the loyalty towards men? And I told him the very same thing, Miss Nancy. I said, no more dad jokes, no more embarrassing men, no more shaming men. I said, how about we start when we see a man leading his family or bringing his family to church or doing what God has called him to do, how about we just pull him aside and say, you know what, well done. You know, great job. I see you. I want to encourage you. Because so much of that secular script, like you say, you know, headship and authority and hierarchy isn't toxic. It's part of a design. It's only toxic when it becomes manipulated, right? I think it was Dallas Willard who said, God's chief aim is to look upon the earth and find men he can entrust with his power, because we're so privy to abuse the power, to neglect the power, and then it goes wheels off. But I just love your voice in that, hey, listen, the evidence is showing, you know, and I want our men to hear this. You said committed evangelicals. We're not talking about cultural Christians or nominal Christians, which we get a lot here in the South.
And that's an important distinction, because the first pushback I always get is, haven't we all heard that Christians divorce at the same rate as the rest of the culture? In fact, when I post about this on Twitter, I always get that response, even now. So what the researchers went back to the data, and they made that distinction that you just mentioned, which is crucial. They sorted out truly committed Christian men, evangelicals, from nominal Christian men, cultural men. By the way, my students don't know what the word nominal means, so I have to tell them NOM is Latin for name. So it means in name only.
Wow, that's so good.
And the nominal Christian men. So these are men who might, on a survey like this, they might check the Baptist box, but they don't actually attend church, rarely, if at all. And they test out with all the toxic stereotypes.
That's right.
Their wives report the lowest level of happiness.
Wow.
With the way their husbands treat them. They spend the least amount of time with their kids. They divorce at a higher rate than even the secular culture, 20% higher.
Wow.
Than the secular culture.
Wow.
And then the real shocker is they have the highest rate of domestic abuse and violence of any group in America, even higher than secular men.
Wow.
So this is what the church is up against. You know, the statistics are going to be misleading if you don't make this distinction.
That's right. Right?
How can the church encourage the men who are doing well, who are testing out as higher than secular men? And how do we reach out to these nominal men who are kind of at the fringes, who are claiming an evangelical identity, but who are actually doing worse than secular men?
And wow.
Who probably are the main reason that evangelicals have a negative reputation.
That's right.
It's because many people are encountering these nominals. And some people have asked me, well, why would they be even worse than secular men, though? And apparently it's because a secular guy who's maybe hitting his wife and kids doesn't feel any religious justification for it. But the nominal Christian man has heard enough, you know, he's hung around the fringes of the Christian world enough to pick up the language of headship and submission without getting the biblical meaning of those terms. He's infused those terms with meaning from the secular script for masculinity, of control and dominance and entitlement. But then he justifies it with religious language.
That's right.
Like, you know, I'm the head, so I can do what I want with my wife and kids. Or she wouldn't submit, so I had to put her in her place.
Wow. You know,
so they end up testing out as worse than secular men. So that's tragic. And that's what we're up against when we, you know, our churches are trying to minister to Christian men.
Because the godly man who is following the Bible, when it says, everybody knows that first part, wives submit to your husbands, but it's that next part, husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church. He would never use a phrase like, she didn't submit, so I had to put her in her place. Because it wouldn't even be in his vernacular, because he's laying down his life. And so what I'm hearing, and I don't want to extrapolate too much on this, but I'm hearing churches that maybe push or promote a nominal or casual Christianity are actually exacerbating the problem. They could be pushing this toxic masculinity either consciously or unconsciously with the promotion of a casual or a nominal Christianity faith.
That's a good point, and especially if the church itself has started to absorb the secular script. And you're seeing that a little bit with the influence of the manosphere.
Yeah.
Right? Even not just the young kids, like I mentioned, the high school kids being drawn into Andrew Tate, but the sort of a Christian manosphere that is picking up the language from the secular script and bringing it into the church. But again, it's because Christians have not use the language of the Bible. Here's what I go to again and again in the book. I think that one reason the church's message has been weak is that it has been somewhat limited. You know, the church operates with kind of a sacred secular split a lot of times, right? And so we draw men into the spiritual side. You know, being a Christian means reading the Bible and praying and going to church, and that's good. But what does it mean outside of just sort of the explicitly religious activities?
Right.
To get a fuller vision, you got to go back to the cultural mandate, which is in Genesis. And again, half my students don't know what that means. So it's in Genesis where, you know, God has created the universe and the plants and the animals and creates the first human couple. What is the very first thing he says to them? Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue the earth. And in the very streamlined language of Genesis 1, we can unpack several layers of meaning there. Be fruitful and multiply doesn't just mean have kids, you know, because historically, as any anthropologist will tell you, all culture flows out of the family. So the family becomes an extended family, a tribe, a clan, you know, a nation.
Wow.
And also gives rise to social institutions for particular purposes, like you need a state, you need a church, you need a school, you need a marketplace. And so be fruitful and multiply really means create all of the social institutions that make a civilization work. And subdue the earth means harness the natural resources. So again, it starts with agriculture, usually.
That's
goes to mining and technology. And goes to, in our own day, inventing computers and composing music. I had one student who said, oh, come on, composing music. So I said, I play the violin. I said, what's the violin made out of? Wood.
That's right.
What's the bow made out of? Horsehair.
Yeah.
So all of the transcendent beauty that we associate with music starts with harnessing the raw materials of creation. So this verse is called the cultural mandate because it means that God's original call to human beings was to create civilizations, to create cultures, you know, to make history. And so that's a much richer vision of what we're calling men to, well, women too, but since we're talking about men, you know, that gives them enough scope for a sense of accomplishment, achievement, mastery, impact. You know, that tells them that the work they do, you guys at Better Man, you focus on vocation. So there you go. You know, focusing on vocation gives men a sense that they've got a bigger calling than just going to church and praying once a week.
Absolutely.
Dorothy Sayers said, if the church does not speak to our work, then it's not speaking to what we do with 9/10 of our time.
That's right.
And no wonder people think the church is irrelevant.
Yeah, well, back to one of your original points. God, numerous times in Scripture, is labeled and called a worker. He worked. And being made in His image, we were made to work. We're most like God. I have a strong conviction that we're most like God when we're working, when we're serving, when we're giving. You know, I think about John 3:16. Everyone knows that verse. You know, God so loved the world that He gave, and we can quote that. But if you just stop right there, God so loved the world that He gave, like, generosity is the heart of everything, the gospel and who God is, that He gave. God's a giver. And when we're giving of our time and our talents and our treasure, of our love, of our service, you know, we're most like God. But to your point, that language seems lost today.
Let me piggyback on that with another study. This is a wonderful study. It's a global study again. So it's even non-Christian cultures, done by an anthropologist, David Gilmore, not a Christian. And he says, he did the first cross-cultural study of concepts of masculinity.
Wow.
And what he found is that in spite of differences between cultures, there is a common core of manhood, what it means to be a man, across all cultures. And he separates it into what he calls the three P's: provide, protect, and procreate. The last one meaning, you know, become a parent.
That's right.
Build into the next generation. And he said, this seems to be, again, a universal, like we said with the other global study that I cited earlier, it's global, it's inherent, it's innate. Men everywhere seem to understand that their unique strengths are not given them to dominate others and,
right,
you know, make it for their own sake, but to love, help, protect, provide for others. And what he found, I didn't put this in the book, you know, for space, you have to cut things.
Right.
But this is why I remembered it when you said giving. He found that every culture has an ethic that the real man is generous.
Wow.
Every culture has a notion that a real man makes enough not just to feed his own family. You start with that. You
know, right.
Provide and protect. You start with your own family, but the real man, you know, the one who... The man who really lives out his full manhood is the one who creates enough that he can give to others.
That's beautiful.
Generosity is part of every culture's code of manhood.
That's right. Innate, universal. One would say a part of a larger design. A part of a larger design. Man, Professor Piercy, it's been so good to be with you and to talk about this. I kind of want to bring us to a close today. And go ahead.
Can we do something on the dad jokes?
Absolutely.
Because you mentioned the dad jokes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So.
And I have something on that.
Please, please. Yeah. So back to, you know, and what I had told that prominent church was, one of the things we have to stop doing is no more dad jokes, right? We've won the children and we've won the women. We need to stop shaming the men with these frivolous jokes. And the whole dad joke movement has been a thing now for a few decades. And I personally think it's offensive and we shouldn't do it.
Everyone knows that fathers are mocked and ridiculed in the media today, right? Yeah. The Homer Simpson pattern.
That's right.
And actually, I even found elite culture saying things similarly. An article in the Atlantic Monthly saying fathers are not needed, you know, or another article that said, you know, despite what we like to say about men, they have no objective contribution to make. So my question is, where did that start? We all know that's a problem, but where did it start? To solve a social trend, you need to go back to where it started and how it developed.
That's a good word.
And once again, it started with the Industrial Revolution, because when men were taken out of the home, for the first time, men got out of touch with their children. You know, compared to when they were spending all day together, they no longer was familiar with their kids' concerns and interests and needs. They were no longer as connected to the family dynamics. And already in the 19th century, you see books and articles coming out saying, well, men, fathers are pretty much superfluous these days. Fathers have become irrelevant and incompetent. That's the key phrase. They were already being treated as incompetent fathers.
Wow.
Because they were not close enough to their families to know what was going on and to be able to solve the problems that came up day to day in their families. The Berenstain Bears, did you ever read them?
I did. I read them to my kids today.
One of my sons loved them. You know, and the father always is the problem maker, not the problem solver.
Wow.
And yeah. So it does give us a sense then that what is the solution? Even in an industrial age, is there a way to flex the workplace to give fathers more time with their kids? Yeah. So I do have a whole chapter in the Toxic War on Masculinity with solutions. And you know, the solutions are easier to sell today because of the pandemic. Because of that pandemic, a lot of fathers discovered they liked being home more and having closer relationship with their children. The Atlantic, the magazine, had an article where they said a lot of families rediscovered the pre-industrial family life where they were working at home, educating the kids at home, even cooking at home. Can you believe that?
That's right.
And rediscovering, in a sense, a kind of home-based connection between work and family that we had before the Industrial Revolution. And Harvard University did a study. This one's not in the book because it's more recent.
Yeah.
But Harvard did a study in which they found the conclusion was during the pandemic, fathers got closer to their children and they don't want to lose that.
Wow.
68% of fathers said they would prefer to have at least a hybrid situation after the crisis is over. They want some kind of flexible hours. In another study, 70% of fathers said if they had to choose flexible hours, even if it came at a reduction in salary, even if they paid the daddy penalty,
wow.
70% said they would rather have, they would choose family, flex time and family time, they would choose over a higher salary.
Wow.
And by the way, a totally different study found the same number of women. I thought that was rather coincidental. 70% of women said they would rather have their husbands home.
Yeah.
You know, at least part-time, at least a hybrid situation. If it meant, even if it meant a lower salary. You know, yes, a lot of men in these studies say they realize they're not going to move up the career ladder as quickly.
That's right.
They may take some hits in terms of salary. But in the surveys, they said it was worth it. It was worth it to have more time with their kids.
Yeah, and that's absolutely beautiful and wonderful and so contrary to the script we hear today, to be your own man, to make a way, to climb the ladder and step on whoever you have to get there, that a lot of these other voices promote. There is this wonderful innate, there's this sense of, hey, I've got this responsibility. I have this progeny. I want to be there with them and for them and to see them succeed. And again, more men need to hear that.
In at least one study that I read about, 95% of fathers said they wish they had more time with their kids.
Yeah.
95%. And it's even higher among young people. Millennials in surveys are more likely to say they really want to share caregiving and breadwinning.
Yeah.
You know, they want to be able to have a more integrated life. Yeah. Unfortunately, the workplace is not set up for that.
That's right.
So most millennials, you know, find that their ideals are somewhat shattered.
Yeah.
But in surveys, they say, we want to share. And by the way, I'm not above appealing to men's self-interest because most of the time, be a better father comes across as kind of the scolding thing.
Sure.
So in my book, I talk about what men gain by becoming fathers.
Wow.
So, for example, one psychologist calls it the dad brain. There is a nest of neurons that don't get activated unless you become a father. Hmm. So that you literally experience brain growth when you become a father.
Wow.
That's how he put it. It's Warren Farrell, who you may know because he's written some really good books on, he wrote a book called The Boy Crisis.
Yes.
And so he writes also on the dad brain.
Come on.
And then they found a couple of things. For example, when your child is born, a man's testosterone goes down, so that he's gentle and patient with children. It's high when he's pursuing a woman.
Well, that's
but
right.
Once he gets married and has kids, he gentles and his testosterone goes down and oxytocin goes up. Oxytocin is the bonding hormone.
Wow.
And so it's what helps you connect with your child.
Yes.
We've always known that a woman's oxytocin goes up during child when she has a baby. But until recently, they didn't know a man's oxytocin goes up too. It turns out it's triggered by a tactile sense. So he has to be actually holding and cuddling and playing with his baby for it to be triggered. And when he does that, the baby's oxytocin goes up too.
That's amazing.
And so a chemical symbiosis is created. A neurological connection is created between the father and his child.
Yes.
And then the final thing, this is the most recent discovery. And it's by an anthropologist. She reports it in a book called The Life of Dad. They discovered that a man's oxytocin is rising all through the 9 months of his wife's pregnancy.
Wow.
So that all through the 9 months, God is preparing the man biochemically, neurologically, to be a full member of the parenting team, to be just as committed to parenting as his wife is. By the way, I guess nobody ever thought of testing a man's blood during his life pregnancy before.
Right, right.
But when they did, they found out, you see, the assumption of social scientists has been that motherhood is natural, fatherhood is a cultural invention.
Wow.
You know, anthropologist Margaret Mead, who's very famous, said that. You know, motherhood is natural, fatherhood is a social convention, or invention is the word she used. Well, that makes men feel like, well, it's not intrinsic to my nature then.
That's right.
You tell men often enough that fatherhood is not intrinsic to your nature, and they will not be motivated to become fathers.
Wow. That's
so right. I think that's why this is so important. No, God has actually biochemically primed men for fatherhood.
Yes.
And they find their truest fulfillment when they do live out fatherhood. And I get questions from single men, so I add this. You can experience a kind of spiritual fatherhood too, as
That's
a single man, by becoming a mentor
That's it.
To young men, by working through your church as a youth group leader, by working with Big Brother organizations.
Yeah. And there's plenty of young men out there that are needing that
because
of the lack of biological and spiritual fathers. It's an epidemic.
So we really need men who are willing to step in and be substitute fathers. And there was, let me give one more thing. I love these studies because, you know, they give you something to sink your teeth in.
That's
these are
so
actual,
good.
These
yes.
are facts.
Yes.
There was a study done on how parents transmit their faith to the next generation. It's called, I think the title of it is Families and Faith. But it was an award-winning study because it was 35 years longitudinal study. So
wow.
Huge study. And they found two surprising things. One is fathers matter more than mothers for passing on their faith.
Yeah.
You know, if the father's a committed Christian, his children are more likely to follow him. If the mother's a Christian, yes, she still has an influence, but the father has a greater influence. The second thing they found is it only works if the father has a close, warm, loving relationship with the child.
Wow.
If the father is a pillar of the church, a moral exemplar, has perfect theology, but the kids perceive him to be cold, distant, authoritarian, they won't follow him.
Hmm.
They won't follow him into the faith. So it's the nature of the relationship that counts. Fathers count more, but they have to have a loving relationship with their kids.
Oh, Professor Piercy, when you say that, I'm reminded of Exodus 20. You know, God gives his children Israel the Ten Commandments. But right before he does it, and most people don't catch this, he reminds them of how much he loves them. He says, I'm the God that provided for you, that brought you out of Egypt. And then
out of the
he
land
gives,
of slavery.
That's it. And then he gives them the rules, right? The relationship always precedes the rules. So many men need to hear that today.
I love that. I that's been very personally meaningful to me.
Hmm.
You know, with coming out of an abusive home.
Yes.
You know, God, when God says, I brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery, that has always been very meaningful to me because of my background.
Yes. Yeah.
One more study. Even secular people are finding how important the father's relationship is. There was a study done on how to produce masculine sons.
Wow. This is interesting.
And the study found the same thing, that it does not matter how masculine the father is. Hmm. So that was interesting. You don't have to be a macho male.
Wow.
You know, you don't have to feel pressure to fulfill these cultural stereotypes.
Sure.
Again, they found that it's the quality of the relationship that counts.
Mm.
If the father has a warm, loving, supportive relationship with the child, with his son, then his son will have a secure sense of masculinity.
Wow. And that's something, something that irritates me is how churches sometimes fall into these stereotypes of men. So every church event has to be throwing an axe, or every church event has to be, you know, some wild game feed where someone hunted something and then they ate it. But that's not all men, you know, and sometimes the church can even feed into these stereotypes of what a man is, when the reality is, no, men can be singers and dancers and painters and electricians and plumbers and all these things. The expressions of masculinity can change, but it's the principles of masculinity that don't change. Those are timeless, you know, because they're rooted, as you talk about, they're rooted in God's design, that innate design, His word, which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I talked to some of the young men here on campus, and they say the worst stereotypes are in the church. You know, some of the men here who, young men, who are, like you said, either more artistically oriented or, oh, they're majoring in psychology.
That's right.
Right? Because they like talking about emotions and relationships.
That's right.
The things that we usually think, you know, girls are interested in. Well, there are boys who are interested in those things.
Yeah.
And they have actually told me the stereotypes are worst in the church, in Christian circles.
That's right.
It's very hard. But this ties in actually to my earlier book, Love Thy Body, because I deal with transgenderism there.
Yeah.
And I tell the story of a young boy who had gender dysphoria because he was a very gentle, sensitive, sweet, relational, emotional boy. And he struggled. He struggled terribly with that because, and he's one of the first to tell me, he was the first person to alert me to this problem. And he said, the churches are where I have the hardest time because the stereotypes are so rigid. It's almost as if the church is trying so hard to stand against the culture that the feminine stereotypes are rigid as well, right? And the masculine stereotypes are rigid. So I think it is important for Christians to look at Scripture. Most commands in Scripture are to both men and to women.
That's right.
You know, the gifts of the Spirit, the fruit of the Spirit, you know, the Sermon on the Mount.
That's right.
All to men and women. You know, there's not a little blue box saying, you know, these gifts of the Spirit are for men.
That's right.
And these gifts of the Spirit are for women.
This fruit over here is for women. This fruit over here is for men. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, prophecy and teaching are not masculine.
That's right.
Which is what we would think. Mercy and service are not feminine.
Come on.
Which is what we would
think. That's such a good word. Yes.
And so we really do need to make sure that we're covering, like you said, the whole range of human personality.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, people say, well, when I was writing the book, of course, after I said that, the first question was, well, what are the differences then? And so I say, well, just let's go back to biology.
That's right.
The most obvious differences are biological.
That's right.
That men are bigger, stronger, faster, 75% greater upper body muscle mass, 90% greater upper body strength.
Wow.
And because of testosterone, in general, they are more aggressive and risk-taking. And it is very important to say these are good qualities. These are the creational givens.
That's right.
Because coming out of an abusive home, I couldn't say that was good.
That's right.
A couple years ago, I did not see those as good traits. I had to train myself in a biblical worldview.
Yes, right.
And say, okay, the way God has created men is good.
That's right.
But the other side of it is, I was on a podcast not long ago with a young woman, and she said, how can men encourage women to be feminine, to be soft and sweet and feminine? And I said, well, they need to respect them when they are.
There you go. That's right.
Because a lot of men, you know, if a man was gentle, emotional, relational, they would interpret that as weakness.
That's right.
They would say, oh, I can walk all over this guy. So they often don't make a mental shift. They often do treat women as if that those are weaknesses.
That's right.
And they don't respect women for being gentle, sensitive, relational.
That's right.
And women pick that up. Why do you think, was it you earlier? I think it was before we started, and you said our culture tells men to be more feminine, men to be more like women, mm-hmm. but it tells women to be more like men.
That's right.
But that's because women sense that feminine qualities are not respected.
That's right.
And even childbearing. I mean, the biggest biological difference, of course, is childbearing.
That's it.
And childbearing means that through much of their adult life, certainly before the Industrial Revolution, through millennia of human history, right, women spent a good bit of their adult life being pregnant, nursing, carrying babes in arms.
That's right.
And usually all three at once.
That's right. Which takes a lot of strength, by the way.
Takes a lot of strength.
That's right.
You know, an infant, when an infant's in distress, you meet their need immediately. You don't reason them with them.
Yeah.
You don't scold them. You don't punish them. No matter what you're doing, you have to stop and meet their distress.
That's right.
So it creates incredible powers of sensitivity, willingness,
intuition,
mm-hmm. ability to understand nonverbal communication.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Did I say patience already? And we need to treat these as strengths.
That's it.
Of course, they become mama bears too. They become sensitive to threats to the baby and the environment.
That's right.
So it's very important that we treat women's strengths as strengths and respect them for that. Mm. You know, you can't counter the feminist movement, you know, insofar as it's, like you said, insofar as it has tended to elevate male characteristics and say women should have those.
Yeah.
But they tend to sort of overlook feminine strengths need to be respected as strengths as well.
Absolutely. That's so good. Professor Piercy, we have a lot of churches, church leaders, men who lead other men that watch our show and tune into the podcast and things of that nature. What would be an encouragement to them? Or if you had a final word or a parting word to them, what would you tell them today that they're listening and watching?
Well, like I said, I wrote the book when I ran into these studies because I said the church needs to get this data out there.
Yeah.
Men need to be encouraged. And by the way, there were two kinds of studies. One of the kinds of studies was just surveys of Christian couples. And I have been asked sometimes by people who are somewhat critical of the book, well, why didn't you talk to the theologians? If you wanted to know what headship means, why didn't you talk to the experts? And I thought, because I was answering the charges from the secular world. The secular world says any belief in male headship in the home will turn men into overbearing, tyrannical patriarchs.
Yeah.
That's an empirical claim.
That's right.
So it needs an empirical answer. Hmm. Namely, does it?
Yeah.
Does it turn men into these overbearing patriarchs, you know, who don't respect or love their wives? And so I went to the surveys of actual Christian men and women.
Wow.
And I was blown away.
Yeah.
When I read their own words, when they talked about how they interpret headship in their own families, their own marriages, how loving and sensitive and mutual and respectful that's how they treat headship, that they treated headship as spiritual leadership.
Mm.
You know, it was responsibility for the well-being of their family. And one pastor even said, if you have to pull rank, you know, if you have to say, do this because I'm the boss, your marriage is already in trouble.
That's right.
I like that quote.
It's such a good word. Yeah.
And another Christian writer put it this way. You know, authority comes from the word author. Hmm. So an author is somebody who creates something, you know, who takes the initiative to create something new. And so authority means the person who takes the initiative to create something better.
Wow.
You know, like if you want your family to have a better spiritual life, you work on your spiritual life.
That's good.
And say, here, follow me. follow me into this deeper walk with Jesus.
Yes.
If you want your home to run in a more organized fashion, you get in there first and start creating something better.
Yes.
You know, and then say, follow me, follow my example.
Yes.
You know, if you want your wife to have a deeper spiritual life, you work on your own first.
That's right.
And lead the way.
Yeah.
And so true leadership is going out in front and living a life that's worthy of emulating.
Come on. So good. That's so good. And let me just add, on behalf of other academicians, you know, sometimes in the church, I think we, because of the felt need or because of the qualitative or emotional, we kind of roll our eyes at the scientific, we roll our eyes at the data, and you're just a breath of fresh air, bringing the empirical, bringing the data, bringing the science to the table and saying, no, this can actually not just reinforce what we know and what we believe, but it can enhance it. That's so good. So good. Fresh Piercy, thank you so much for your time today. And we're just so grateful. Your book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, is so good. Obviously, we're going to continue to recommend it. And
can I hold it up?
Absolutely, yeah.
Can you hold it up? Oh, it's under your computer, I think.
Absolutely. There you are. Yeah. Your book, The Toxic War on Masculinity, that's right. And can we get this anywhere?
Oh, yes. Amazon and ChristianBook.com.
Yeah.
I always say ChristianBook.com to encourage people to go to their Christian sites.
That's right.
And also, my publisher very generously redesigned my website. So it's fun and colorful now. So come on over to NancyPiercy.com and browse my other books and leave a message. You can leave comments, which is fun. They're fun to read. And
absolutely.
I love that. So
absolutely.
Come on over to nancypiercy.com and say hello.
Yeah, Professor Piercy, thank you for being a voice of truth and encouragement and inspiration.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Hey, brothers, if we want to finish strong, we need to start strong. And I can't think of a better way to start your day than with some encouragement from God's Word. That's what Better Mornings, the Better Man Daily Devotional, is all about. Start your morning with Better Mornings and be the man God has called you to be. Check out the link in the show notes or visit betterman.com/resources and sign up for Better Mornings, the Better Man Daily Devotional.